has three density scrolls in his study. At the time, the civil authority for Jews in Palestine was called the Jewish Agency for Palestine. The unofficial, well, official precursor to the Israeli government. And he couldn't get, things were chaotic at the time. He gave them word of these scrolls that he needed public funds to back him to be able to purchase the scrolls. But they couldn't get word back to him because bullets were beginning to fly around Jerusalem, and the last thing that the Jewish Agency for Palestine was concerned about was some dusty old scrolls. So he actually made plans to mortgage his home to raise money so he could purchase these scrolls. But eventually the Jewish Agency for Palestine was able to back him. He purchased the first three Dead Sea Scrolls. But what's interesting is Sukkot didn't tell anybody about it. He kept them in his study and continued to study them. He wanted to make an assessment of what he had before he told the world. So you have Eleazar Sukenik with the first three Dead Sea Scrolls coming to a scholar's hands who's able to identify what they are. And I'm not criticizing him, but he just sort of sits on it. Now, the Bedouin, let's go back before Sukenik. Who discovered the scrolls? Probably in late 1946 or mid-1947. A Bedouin shepherd is looking for a lost sheep. The media has made it out to be a boy who threw a rock. Actually, he was probably about 30 years old. His name was Mohammed Adib. He was looking for a lost sheep, and he was a guy with the metal detector and was a Californian, would be in the hills with his metal detector, banging for gold. He was a guy who made a hobby of looking for treasure in the desert. Because he knew that there are antiquities in the desert. This is Israel, after all. People have been there a long time. And if he found something, he could change his life forever as a poor shepherd in the desert. He's looking for a lost sheep, and he throws a rock in a cave. The way I think about this is there's times I've been on hikes in the mountains of California, and I see a cave, you pick up a rock, and you just kind of heave it. Now, there are several coincidences about the Dead Sea Scrolls. One of them is the first time a Jewish scholar read a Dead Sea Scroll. From the last time there was an independent Jewish state in Palestine was on the day the UN voted to create a new Jewish state in Palestine. Think about that for a moment. The next coincidence is that a man throws a rock into a cave. And actually, I think it would be better to say he chucked a rock in a cave. I think that's the way it was done. It flies through the air to a fairly large cave with rock walls and a sandy dirt bottom and flies almost by divine guidance, you'd have to say, and hits a clay pot in the back of that cave. He hears the crack of something shattering in the back of the cave due to his rock. Could have hit anything else and he would have never came back. He comes back and he and other members of his Bedouin tribe lower a small boy down into the cave. He scrambles to the back and finds several clay jars stacked against the back of the cave, their lids sealed with tar. He rips off the lids and they discover eight intact scrolls. Here's what Mohammed Adib told to a journalist later. We kept them lying around the tent, and the children played with them. One of them broke into pieces, and we threw the pieces on the garbage pile. Later we came back, and we realized how valuable these were. Later we came back and found that the wind had blown all the pieces away. Now, there are some Dead Sea Scroll fragments that made it into private hands. And we're now at the time that that first generation of people are older, and many of them are dying. And so these fragments are being passed on to children who realize, wow, granddad had a Dead Sea Scroll fragment that he bought from an antiquities dealer in 1949. And they are entering the antiquities market again. And so just imagine $75,000 worth of little fragments being blown across the sands of the desert. And if it's a nice fragment, a lot more than $75,000. The Bedouin take the scrolls to a cobbler who went by the name of Kando in Bethlehem. Now, he was a cobbler by trade, but Bethlehem was the economic center of the Bedouin, and occasionally Bedouin would discover archaeological artifacts. And so Candle ran an antiquity shop out of the back of his cobbler shop. And they brought the fragments to him. Now, Candle couldn't read Hebrew. He had no idea what they were. He was a Palestinian man living in Bethlehem. He sent some of the fragments up to a friend in Jerusalem to see if he could identify what they were. This man, let's see, his name was George Isaiah, not an important fact, but he was a Syrian Orthodox Christian, a Middle Eastern Orthodox Christian of the Syrian Orthodox Church. He took them to Mar Athanasius Samuel, who was the Archbishop of the Syrian Orthodox Christians of Jerusalem. And he was wondering if someone on the staff of the monastery, the bishop, would be able to read them and say what they were. Now, Athanasius Samuel, the archbishop, couldn't read Hebrew, but he was a smart man, and he realized a war was going to occur between Palestinians and Jews. And he realized that many of his parishioners would become refugees. He thought these might be valuable. They looked old, they were in Hebrew, there's going to be a buyer. So he spent his life savings of about $250 and offered it to the Bedouin through this antiquities dealer, through another antiquities dealer in Jerusalem, to buy the scrolls the Bedouin had. So the Bedouin come up from Bethlehem with the scrolls to sell them to the Syrian Orthodox Archbishop. And he looks at it as something that could be resold at value, because there's going to be conflict and money is going to be at a premium. He's thinking smart. The Bedouin, these dirty Bedouin with scrolls, come to the gate of the monastery where the bishop lives. And the gatekeeper says, there's no way that the bishop is going to have business with the likes of you. A gatekeeper turns away the Bedouin with the scrolls in their arms. When the archbishop hears about this, he says, find those Bedouin, I want those scrolls. They go into the streets of Jerusalem and find the Bedouin, but the Bedouin are so insulted, some of them will no longer deal with the archbishop. There are 7 scrolls in their possession. Those myth Bedouin take 3 scrolls back to Bethlehem. Those are the 3 scrolls that made it into the hands of Eleazar Sekhem. Those 3 scrolls. The Bedouin still have 4 scrolls, and they sell them to the archbishop. The archbishop now has a job to do. He has to figure out what they are and whether they're valuable. He sends out feelers into leading members of the Syrian Orthodox community to say, do you know anybody who has connections who can tell me what these scrolls are? There's a wealthy Palestinian man, a Syrian Christian by the name of Anton Kiraz, who says, I've got a friend at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. His name is Eleazar Sekhem. Why don't we call him? He'll be able to tell us what these are. And by the way, he tried other people first. He went to the librarian of the Hebrew University, the same institution where Sekhenik taught. And the librarian, who didn't know Sekhenik by now, who had scrolls, the librarian said they're probably forgeries and handed them back to the archbishop. Now, why would the librarian say that? There were no Jewish documents in the world this old. These are sui generis. There's nothing like them. And actually saying they're a hoax and a fraud was an early scholarly opinion when the scrolls were first discovered. And it took a couple decades for the idea that they could be a fraud to be pushed to the sidelines and for them to be recognized as authentic. So, I need to move this story along. Back to Sukenik's diary. One day toward the end of January 1948, so we're basically 3 months after Sukenik visited, 2 months after Sukenik visited Bethlehem and returned with 3 scrolls that he got public funds to buy. One day toward the end of January 1948, I received a letter from the Arab quarter of Jerusalem. It had taken 3 days to come from the other side of the city. The letter was from an acquaintance of mine, a member of the Syrian Orthodox Christian community. In his letter, the Syrian wrote that he wished to show me some ancient Hebrew scrolls, which he had in his possession, and wondered where we could meet. We decided on the YMCA building in Jerusalem. That sounds odd, but if you've been to Jerusalem and you've seen the YMCA building on David Street, It's one of the more magnificent buildings in the city. It actually was a realistic choice. This was in Military Zone B, and I equipped myself with the necessary pass to get through the British Guards. At the time, the YMCA building was much used as a meeting place for Arab leaders. In order not to arouse too much comment, I packed several books under my arm and entered the YMCA building as if I were about to change these volumes at the library. I saw many Arabs sitting on the terrace. They looked startled to see me, a Jew, enter this building, and they must have thought me a crazy bookworm that they could use in the YMCA library at such a time. I was happy to spot my friend among the sitters. The YMCA librarian, who was also a Syrian Orthodox Christian and who had been apprised in our meeting, saw me and ushered me into a private room. He asked me to wait a few moments. Shortly afterward, my friend appeared. From a safe in the room, the two of them produced several ancient scrolls, which they put on the table. There, to my great joy, I saw a scroll containing what looked to me to be the entire book of Isaiah, which was the scroll we saw slide, the only complete Dead Sea Scroll, 22 feet long. He does the same thing he did before. He says, "Can I take these home?" But he doesn't indicate. He doesn't indicate that he has three more just like it at home. He says, "Can I take these home with me and evaluate them? I have no idea if they're valuable." You know, he has to keep a poker face. These are antiquities dealers. This is negotiation. This is the Middle East, and it's a black market. So he keeps a poker face, gives no indication that he knows exactly what they are and that they're extremely valuable, and says, "I need to take them home with me to study." He contacts the Jewish Agency for Palestine and says, "Can you give me public funds to buy additional scrolls?" But a war is beginning to break out, and they are not able to get word back to Sekenik that they will back him with whatever he needs to purchase the scrolls. So he returns 3 days later to a second meeting at the YMCA building, the scrolls under his arms, having to return them. He has no money. He has no leverage because he mortgaged his home the last time, got repaid, but he has no economic leverage. He has nothing to offer. So he sits down at the table, keeping his poker face. They say, "Are they valuable?" He says, "Well, they might be." They say, "Do you want them?" He says, "Of course. I'd love to have them for the Hebrew University." "What are you willing to offer?" "Well, what are you asking?" "Well, we don't know. We don't know." "What are you offering?" And he says, "What are you asking?" And they just keep turning the tables on each other, no one willing to name a price. And the deal falls through, he returns home. Now, I think that Anton Kiraz, who was there representing the Archbishop, was a smart man too. And he probably recognized in Sukenik's eyes that these were valuable. Because immediately he starts looking for someone else to sell them to, and someone else to confirm their value. There could be multiple motivations. One, Sukenik is a Jewish inhabitant of the city, they're Palestinian. And they may have questioned selling to a Jewish person, because they're starting to be at war with each other at this moment. Also, they probably wanted to look for more and more buyers to up the price. So they began to look for other people who might be able to tell them that they're valuable. They call a variety of scholars and different people in the city, most of whom look at the scrolls and do not think that they're valuable, most of whom think they're a fraud. They take them to a father in the monastery named Boutros Salmi, who took the scrolls to the American Archaeological Institute in Jerusalem, now called the Albright Institute. The director, Millar Burroughs, was away in Baghdad on business, because Baghdad at the time was a beautiful, peaceful city where you could do a lot of business in an important place. And Jerusalem at that time was the city in chaos. But the director was away on business, and a young PhD by the name of John Trevor was in charge of the institute with his friend, whose name escapes me. But they bring the scroll to this young scholar who's barely wet behind the ears, having finished his PhD at Yale. They have this great Isaiah scroll, 22 feet long. They take it up to their dorm room, and they upstairs the institute unroll it on their beds. And they are looking at the writing. They're not seasoned scholars like Sekenik. They can't read this right away. They know they're Hebrew. but they're not familiar with the forms of the letters, like Sukenik was as an archaeologist. They study it and they realize this is Isaiah, but how old is it? They bring down a book from the library that gives samples of Hebrew writing through the ages. It probably opened up to the Middle Ages, which would be a good guess if you don't know what it is. It doesn't look like medieval Hebrew. They go more modern, doesn't look like anything. They go more ancient. And then at the very beginning of the book, they find an image of a little piece of papyrus discovered in Egypt called the Nash Papyrus. Nash was the British guy who bought it on the antiquities market in Egypt. But it has the Ten Commandments on it. It's not a fragment of a biblical scroll. It's like a Christian wearing a cross around their neck. Someone in the ancient world, a Jewish person living in Egypt, kept a copy of the Ten Commandments in their pocket. But it dates from about the same time as the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they recognize the writing was identical. And so this young scholar, John Trevor, sees, oh my word, we have a 2,000-year-old copy of the book of Isaiah on my bed. They take it, the priest, Buter Salmi, takes it back to the monastery. Oh, and they told the young scholars, we found these scrolls in the monastery library. Everyone has a poker face. It's the antiquities market. John Trevor says, can I come photograph them? Because if you want people to know how valuable they are, we need to document them. And luckily, John Trevor was an amateur photographer of some accomplishment. He died just a couple of years ago here in Southern California. And he said he couldn't find medium format portrait film that was not past its expiration date in the city. So he had expired portrait film, and he took beautiful color images of these scrolls. And it's through John Trevor's photographs that he took in 1948 that is how the world learned of the Dead Sea Scrolls. He sent one of those photographs to William Albright, who was the greatest biblical scholar, probably American biblical scholar of his generation, who wrote back when he received images from John Trevor of the scrolls. Albright wrote back, my heartiest congratulations on the greatest manuscript discovery of modern times. There is no doubt whatever in my mind that the script is more archaic than that of the Nash Papyrus. I should prefer a date around 100 BCE. I repeat that in my opinion you have made the greatest manuscript discovery of modern times, certainly the greatest biblical manuscript found. Burroughs will now have a chance to forget the events in Palestine for a while. Let us hope that nothing happens to your precious funds. Now, the next events happen very quickly. There are bombs dropping in Jerusalem. Albright said these scrolls need to be protected. Millar Burroughs, the director of the Institute, returns from Baghdad and says, we need to protect these scrolls. They decide we need to move them out of Jerusalem. So Mar Athanasius Samuel, the archbishop, takes the scrolls out of Jerusalem, into Lebanon, into Beirut, at the time a beautiful, peaceful city. When he did that, he broke Jordanian antiquities law. You can't smuggle antiquities across the border. And he was declared a smuggler and a traitor to be arrested at the border if he ever returned to Palestine. He comes to the United States in 1949 to look for a buyer for the scrolls. He's not a wealthy man, and literally he starts to go penniless, bringing the scrolls to the U.S. to find a buyer. And amazingly, he can't find one. Yale University considered using some of its acquisition funds for its library to buy the scrolls from the archbishop. But the problem was, many scholars still believed they were a fraud, that they were forgeries. So would you bet on a possible fraud? Secondly, Sukenik appeared when he heard they were on the market, and he said, now wait a second. First, aren't they Jewish scrolls? And second, wasn't I given the right of first refusal on purchasing them? Then Anton Kiraz appears, this wealthy man who consulted with the patriarch. He's now a refugee. He needs cash. And he says, I claim 50% of what's ever sold because I'm not the archbishop. Then the state of Jordan says, these are Jordan antiquities that were smuggled up. If someone buys it, they're going to face a suit from the government of Jordan. Then it's rumored that he's asking well over $1 million for the scrolls. Now, by today's standards, $1 million for four Dead Sea Scrolls the biggest, most beautiful, most well-preserved scrolls, because they were in jars, would be a steal. But this is 1949, and $1 million was a heck of a lot of money. So no one buys them. So Kennick has died. He wrote in his diary, never able to recover those four scrolls, he wrote in his diary, thus the Jewish people have lost a great heritage. His son, Yigael Yadin, in 1957, 8 years later, and the archbishop still can't sell these things. His son, Yigael, no, it's 1954 actually, but his son is on a lecture tour in the United States, lecturing on what? The Dead Sea Scrolls. And he sees an ad in the Wall Street Journal. Not that big a deal, but I'd like to read you the ad. Four Dead Sea Scrolls. Biblical manuscripts dating back to at least 200 BC are for sale. That's a little old, but they're selling here. This, and no one knew the age yet. That took a while to figure out. But four biblical manuscripts dating back to at least 200 BC are for sale. This would be an ideal gift to an educational or religious institution by an individual or group. And there's a box number, Wall Street Journal. Yigael Yadin knows immediately these are the scrolls that his father tried to buy and lost. He realizes this is his chance to make history. He can't, however, as Yigael Yadin, who led military operations against Palestinians, to approach a Palestinian living in the United States and say, I'd like to buy your scrolls on behalf of the State of Israel. That's not going to fly. So he realizes he can't do it. He calls a friend of his who's a biblical scholar at New York University named Harry Orlinsky. And he said, and what's interesting, there's so many details about this. Harry Orlinsky was in his car backing out his driveway to take his family on vacation. And the phone rings. And it's one of those things, should I go in? So he runs back in to get the phone, and Yadin, his good friend, says, Harry, drop the vacation. You have to do something for me. So he, with lawyer in tow, he meets the archbishop in the safe deposit box at a bank in New York City. And he goes under the name of Joe Green to disguise his identity. But he's a biblical scholar who can confirm these are the authentic Dead Sea Scrolls. He confirms they're authentic Dead Sea Scrolls, and the State of Israel buys them to intermediaries for a mere, even at that time, $250,000. Those seven scrolls are reunited. Those seven scrolls, if you visit the Shrine of the Book Museum in West Jerusalem across the street from the Knesset, those are the scrolls at the Shrine of the Book. Now we have the story of 893 scrolls yet to be told. We've only done seven. So we have a lot of work to do. Make some more coffee. I'm going to skip a lot of details at this point. The Bedouin discovered cave one. Those seven scrolls came from cave number one. The Bedouin realized these were valuable. So the Bedouin, who had access to the desert at this time, there were still hostilities between Palestinians and Israelis, are looking in the desert for more scrolls. And they're bringing scrolls up to Jerusalem. And the Jordanian government interceded to buy them so the scrolls would be in public hands and not disappear under the black market of antiquities. And started to buy the scrolls from the Bedouin. Then, in September of 1952, all of a sudden, the Bedouin start bringing more scrolls. And more scrolls. Fragments. Thousands and thousands of fragments. They discovered cave 4 in September of 52. They're bringing so many fragments up that the Jordanian authorities work out a price per square centimeter with the Bedouin. So they just pay according to surface area of Dead Sea Scroll fragments to the Bedouin. And, well, actually, they're paying Kando. That cobbler set himself up as an intermediary between the Bedouin and the Jordanian government. If he's the only guy who prospered from the scrolls, the Bedouin actually didn't get a whole lot out of this, even though they did all the work. Now, the problem is there are so many fragments coming that it's emptying the coffers of the Jordanian Ministry of Culture. The government doesn't have enough money to keep buying fragments. So So they appeal to Western institutions to buy scrolls. And they tell universities and churches and things in America and in Europe, if you buy some fragments, once the editors are done publishing the fragments, you can take them home. But help us buy the fragments. There's a church in New York, Riverside Church, buys the Dead Sea Scroll. Yale University realizes their mistake and buys the Dead Sea Scroll. Several universities in Germany buy Dead Sea Scrolls. Later, the Jordanian government nationalized the scrolls, so nothing ever went home to the buyers. We can debate whether that was a good idea or a bad idea. Ultimately, it was probably a good idea for the scrolls ultimately. But they collect the scrolls in Jordan in the Palestine Archaeological Museum. And scholars, they assemble a team to publish Cave 4. The scrolls became controversial. They were discovered in 11 caves between 1947 and 1956. Most of the caves were published in good time. The controversy of the lack of publication of the scrolls was mainly just Cave 4. They decided to appoint a team of 8 editors. They knew this was a big task. They looked for young scholars who were rising stars in the field. There's been innuendos and rumors that the reason that Cave 4 wasn't published is because the scholars didn't know the Hebrew well enough. That's absolute poppycock. One of the dissertations by one of those scholars was analyzing dialectical differences between older layers of Hebrew and later layers of Hebrew within the Bible. These guys knew the languages, they knew the history, they knew the archaeology. They were rising stars as scholars. There were 4 of them. 2 Germans, 2 French, 2 British, 2 Americans. 8 scholars. 4 of them Roman Catholic, 4 of them Protestant. Who's missing? Jewish scholars, sort of obvious. But they were Jordanian scrolls, and they fought a war with Israel, and so the Jordanians said one thing: no Jewish editors, whether Israeli or not. That did not affect the scholarship of the scroll because these scholars were excellent. It did affect scholarship in this way, though. The scrolls that were most interesting to a Christian scholar tended to be scrolls that had some link to the New Testament and to the kinds of thinking within Judaism that would make it into the New Testament. Scrolls that were more distant from Christian interests tend to be less emphasized in the earliest layer of scholarship. But other than that, they generally did good work as they began. Now, John D. Rockefeller put up the money to pay for them so they could work full time. The scholars arrived in Israel to work on Cave 4 beginning in 1953, and they started to pull apart the mountain of fragments and to sort them to make sense of them. By about 1956, they had sorted the fragments into their scrolls. That actually is fantastic progress, to sort them out. By 1960, they had ordered the fragments, which again is very important, very difficult, because the 2 fragments don't go together. There is a gap in between. And so when you arrange them, that means you're interpreting what the scroll says, and you have a guess as to what's in between the 2 fragments. And so you're putting the fragments where they should go if there was a complete scroll. So in 7 years, their notebooks had preliminary transcriptions of all of the scrolls of Cave 4, meaning they had put the fragments in order, and they had written in Hebrew what the scroll would have said if we had the whole thing. Now, if those scholars had Xeroxed their notebooks and distributed them, they would have been heroes. In 7 years, you made sense of 15,000 tiny fragments and gave the world 600 ancient Jewish scrolls, including biblical manuscripts and other things that we didn't have before, along with the less than a third of the remaining scrolls from the other caves. They would have been heroes. The problem was, well, it's all the problems of the scholarly world came to a head in these editors and ruined everything they tried to do. First of all, there was no accountability. Lack of funding. I work in the humanities and I know all about lack of funding. And John D. Rockefeller died and left no provision in his will for them to continue their work. Their funding disappeared overnight. They had to go home to their home universities. They had classes to teach. Students were banging on their doors for counseling and advice about the class and the test coming up. And they had to go to committee meetings, the bane of every academic is all those committees. So suddenly, the Scrolls became part-time. Also, they had no accountability, which again is what scholars want. That's the meaning of tenure. But when you have a massive publication project that other scholars are interested in, accountability would have been a good thing, but there was no accountability whatsoever. Also, a man named Roland DeVoe, a French scholar, was in charge of the editorial team, and he set out an agenda for the editors that was way too ambitious. What they should have done is publish books with pictures of the fragments, a transcription, meaning writing in Hebrew what it should say, and an English or French or German translation, depending on the language of the editor, and just got it out there. Again, they would have been heroes if they had done it. But Roland DeVoe wanted them to be like a cabal that worked on these scrolls and generated not only what they said, but how they should be interpreted. And so they were encouraged to try to say the last word about where the language of the scroll would fit into the history of the Hebrew language. Where the thoughts in this scroll would have fit into the history of Judaism and nascent Christianity. Where this scroll would fit into the politics of the day, and there's no way any living individual can do all of that. And so they took on an almost obsessive concern to have the last word on every scroll they published. And I know people who knew the editors and said when you talked with them, they felt that they had been pushed into this position where they had to say the last word. And that also is a scholarly curse. The scholars want to say the last word if they're publishing on something. Then also, there's just the simple thing that you think you can do more in the time you have, you can't. Everybody does that. Sarah knows I do that a lot. But scholars are particularly bad at that problem. So slowly, they're just driving themselves down a dark alley that had nothing to do. The Vatican did not suppress the Dead Sea Scrolls. The scroll scholars were experts in the languages. The simple, mundane reasons they didn't get them published was they didn't have the time, and they thought they could do more than they could with the time they had, and they didn't have any funding. But then what happens, if you've been working on something for 10 or 15 years of your life, and someone else asks you for it, and you're not done with it, you grab it even tighter and tighter. And what happened, though, when you're a scholar and you want to publish a book, you want all the evidence. Because if you don't have all the evidence, someone's holding evidence you don't have, and your book is worthless. The problem is there are 900 Dead Sea Scrolls. A couple hundred of them have been published. There are 600 Dead Sea Scrolls, the only documents in the world that testify to how Judaism was forming. Because the religion of the Old Testament is not Judaism. The religion of the Old Testament is a religion of temple and sacrifice. And last time I visited a synagogue, there was no sacrifice. The religion of Judaism grew out of the Old Testament and developed and evolved. And when did that happen? The time of the Dead Sea Scrolls. How much evidence do we have of that evolution? The Dead Sea Scrolls. A little bit more, but not much more. When was Christianity born, and who were the conversation partners of Jesus? Why did Jesus say the things he said? The Dead Sea Scrolls rarely cause us to reevaluate what Jesus said and completely reinterpret it, but they tell you why he thought that issue was really important. What is the only evidence on the planet Earth that helps us understand why Jesus thought certain issues were important and not others? Right there in the scrolls. And there are 8 people sitting on 600 of them for 44 years. You can't see them. Now, when the problem became dramatic, they gave them to their students to publish as dissertations. But if you're a scholar like Geza Ramesh at Oxford, who wasn't a member of the editorial team, the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered when you got your PhD. And you think, I'm going to spend my life studying the Dead Sea Scrolls. What a great time to get a PhD in the study of early Judaism. You're approaching retirement age, and you still haven't seen 2/3 of them. But you find out the young PhDs in their 20s who are wet behind their ears are being given them because they're students of the editors. That just gets you mad. Carla?
About how much information would be on one scroll? I mean, looking at a couple of newspaper sheets, or?
We're going to read one in our next session.
Okay. Okay.
That would be the best way to answer that question. How much is on a scroll? We'll read one. Now, the problem is getting worse and worse and worse. 5 minutes. We're going to finish this story next time. I hate to tell you that. I'm going to bring you up to the crib. Okay. 1967, now all of the editors were pro-Palestinian. Why? They lived working on the scrolls in East Jerusalem among Palestinians, living with Palestinians. They were, of course, pro-Palestinian. The Six-Day War occurs. East Jerusalem becomes part of Israel. The Rockefeller Museum, where they were working, is now controlled by Israel, and they refuse to keep working. The publication series of books on the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were being published in a set of books by Oxford University Press. The books were called Discoveries in the Judean Desert of Jordan. Now that's the Judean Desert of Israel. So we have a political problem. And I'm going to read you what happened with the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Six-Day War in 1967. I'm skipping parts, but this is fun. I got the wrong book. During the war, the Jordanians fortified the Palestinian Archaeological Museum and put gun emplacements in its main tower because the museum is strategically located outside the northeast corner of the city, overlooking vital north-south roads in the Jerusalem area. On June 6, Israeli paratroopers entered the building and secured it after feeble Jordanian resistance. One lieutenant, like most Israelis keenly interested in archaeology, immediately began to search for the Dead Sea Scrolls, but the display case was empty. Avraham Baran, director of the Israel Department of Antiquities, received a call that day from Carmela Yadin, Yigal's wife. She told him that Yadin had been notified that the museum would soon be in Israeli hands, and asked if Baran would go to the museum and make sure that the scrolls and other antiquities were safe. Baran needed no arm twisting. He and two other archaeologists went with him to the museum, where they were obliged to go in the back door, since paratroopers were still engaged in a firefight in the front of the museum with Jordanians on the city walls. City walls are right across the street from the museum. Some of the paratroopers immediately conscripted Baran to give them, during the battle, an impromptu lecture and tour of the antiquities of the museum. The archaeologist was happy to oblige and led a few of the soldiers around the premises, with the sound of shooting and breaking glass coming from the front of the building. The next day, after the entire city had been secured, the paratroopers left. Some of them dutifully signed the guest registry as they filed out, complete with banal comments, fantastic, very pleasant. Baran and the others could not find the scrolls. Weeks later, they were finally located in a basement safe behind the display case. The safe contained K4 and K11 fragments. The copper scroll and some additional fragments of K1 had been moved to the Amman Museum in Jordan, where they remain to this day. Eventually, a compromise was worked out between the Ministry of Antiquities, the Antiquities Department of Israel, the Antiquities Authority, as it's now called, and the editors of the scrolls. They would change the books to the title Discoveries in the Judean Desert. Of Jordan would be deleted, and Israel would not be mentioned in the preface to any of the volumes. Okay, so they come up with a compromise, the editors continue working. We're getting into the late 70s and 80s, and it's starting to become a problem. At normally staid scholarly conferences, when scholars are quiet and they listen respectfully to each other, there are fingers being pointed and they're yelling at each other because of the scrolls. Gays of Ramesh holds a Dead Sea Scrolls conference in Oxford, and with the editors in the room says, someone needs to do something immediately. I won't find his words and read them since we got about a minute left. But he basically says, release the information you have now save your reputations before they're gone. Into this mix enters a man named Herschel Shanks. Herschel Shanks is a lawyer. He's a fan of biblical archaeology, and he edits a magazine called Biblical Archaeology Review. Great magazine if you're interested in these kinds of things. Big color pictures, great articles on the history of Israel. Now, he needs to sell magazines like any magazine editor. And what better way to sell a magazine than make your magazine the crusader for the release of the Dead Sea Scrolls? Now, there were a couple editors-in-chief. Roland DeVoe was the first one, a couple other guys, Pierre Benoit, who was a very nice Frenchman who didn't have the mettle to deal with the situation as it got out of hand. Then there was a man named, oh my word, I'm forgetting his name. A young scholar at Harvard who was a depressive alcoholic and one of the original K4 editors. A couple of friends of mine who are scholars believe that the reason the other editors elected him as editor-in-chief, even though he was a depressive alcoholic who was on medication, was they knew things were going to get politically bad, and they set him up as a straw man. And I say this because he was actually a nicer man and a better man, John Strugnell, than what ultimately came about. But he had a tendency, Strugnell's personality was that he liked to say controversial things to stir the pot and get everyone upset. People who know him say he was a gentle man, but the combination of his personality that he said nasty things in public and gentle things in private, and that he was a depressive alcoholic led to some very bad things. He was interviewed by a major network news in the United States, and they said, "What do you think about the other scholars who are criticizing you and saying release the scrolls?" He said, "They're like flies and gnats biting us." So Herschel Shanks put John Strugnell's portrait on the front of his magazine with little gnats with the names of scholars who didn't have access to the scrolls on the little gnats and flies. So Herschel Shanks is selling a lot of magazines. The next thing that happened, and this is very bad, I know a lot of people who knew Strugnell and know Strugnell and say he's a better man than this. But he had his problems. But he's interviewed by the Jerusalem Post, major newspaper in Jerusalem. They're asking him questions about the scrolls, and they start to realize he's starting to dissemble in front of them. And so they start to press him. "Why won't you release the scrolls? What do you think of Jewish scholars who are generally not editors?" But to John Strugnell's credit, he increased the size of the editorial team, and he added Jewish scholars, both Israelis and non-Israelis, to the editorial team. He added also women editors to the team, to his credit. But then the reporter asked him, "What do you think of Judaism?" He said, and I quote, "Judaism is a horrible religion," to the Jerusalem Post. There is no better way to end your relationship with the Dead Sea Scrolls than to say something like that. Now, so the things, that's just to say the things went from bad to worse. I'm getting a sign like this from the back. So I'll end with this. The politics are getting worse and worse. John Strugnell is no longer editor-in-chief. He's replaced by a man named Emmanuel Tob, a young Israeli scholar. The team is now larger and larger, but still after 44 years, most scholars have never seen these Dead Sea Scrolls. Something now begins to happen. There are people who are in favor of release, who are in positions of access. There's a man named Robert Eisman who teaches at Cal State Long Beach here in Southern California, who's on, lovingly I should say, he's on the lunatic fringe of Dead Sea Scroll scholarship. But who do the media put a microphone in front of? The lunatic fringe. So he's the guy quoted more than any other scholar in the media saying we need access to these Dead Sea Scrolls. Someone in Israel who had access to images, photographs taken of the scrolls when they were first discovered. There's about 4,000 of these negatives that are precious. Because as the scrolls deteriorate, the negatives record what they said. He's getting packets of negatives in the mail. Anonymous. Then there's a young PhD student at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, a rabbinical seminary. His doctoral advisor is a Dead Sea Scroll scholar, but not one of the editors who can't see the scrolls. I'll leave with this one little story and then we'll quit. His advisor is becoming legally blind. And he wants his advisors to be able to read the scrolls before he is fully blind. It turns out the editors made a concordance of all the fragments from K4. Concordance, there are biblical concordances. You can find every time the word father occurs in the Bible, and it'll give you the words before and after the word father. And to help them put the fragments together, they made a concordance of all those fragments. Well, they put that concordance in the library at Hebrew Union College because some scholars asked for it. Well, this young student who was kind of a computer geek realized, I can start with any entrance in the concordance. It gives me a word, and it gives me the next word on that fragment. Then I can look for that word in the concordance, it will give me the next word. And if I enter the concordance into my computer, I can use some simple routines in a database software and reconstruct the Dead Sea Scrolls. So he's sitting in his room typing. There's one other thing that's happening to release the scrolls, and the only person that knows these things that are going on behind the scenes to get the scrolls released is a man named Herschel Schick, who's pushing all of them saying, you better get this done or someone else is going to beat you, and releasing the unpublished Dead Sea Scrolls. So we'll finish the story at the end.